on this monster episode of Baseball Barbacast. The Cubs can't lose. Wrigley Field is a wonderland. The Rays, are they really this good? We'll talk about it. Spencer Jones, is he the next Aaron Judge? I say no. Jordan says absolutely. Then we do the good, bad, the ugly, some of your emails, and I had a very deep conversation with a mascot that I will tell you about later. All that and more on what was a vintage episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world falling asleep to Go Cubs Go on repeat. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And go, Cubs. Go.
This team will not be stopped. I think if they kept playing the Reds in perpetuity, they would never lose. That was my takeaway from the Cubs-Reds four-game series, the Cubs' second mop of the season, and that is, of course, our opener.
Now, I am not a Cubs fan or a Cubs writer, but these have to be the highest, most immaculate vibes at the friendly confines that we have seen since the heyday of Schwarber, Bryant, Rizzo, Baez, James Russell. Things on the north side are hopping right now. The Cubbies have won 9 in a row, and more delightfully, they have won 15 consecutive games at Wrigley Field. The longest win streak at home for this franchise since 1935. Now, granted, for a lot of that time, the Cubs kind of sucked, right? However, what they have done recently at home has been incredible, and the energy, the atmosphere at Wrigley, I was there last weekend. It continued this week with this mop. Things are going quite well for the Cubs.
For those curious, that 1935 club did win 100 games, lost in the World Series in 6 games to the Tigers. Mm. However, if this Cubs team, I mean, this is kind of a weird question. It's like, would they sign up to lose in the World Series right now? Kind of a weird thing to think about. Would that be considered a successful season? I think yes, but you know, you don't want spoilers, right? You don't want to know how this magical story is going to end. So you don't want to jump too far ahead yet. I think the thing I'm thinking about, and because you were in Chicago and you kind of described what it was like to be there, and now they just keep winning and winning. When you say, okay, this is as high as the vibes have been since, you know, 16, and maybe that's true. I would really love to hear from Cubs fans how this feels so far compared to last year. Because I do think that there were times last season as they were barreling back towards the postseason where you had moments like this. Now, I know they didn't have a win streak like this at home, but I think you would see bits and pieces. I think this team, though there are certainly question marks on the mound that continue mostly due to injury, I think there's something about the proof of concept that we got last year where there's a level of confidence and security that it's like, no, we arrived as a really good baseball team in this era last year. So we're not looking around wondering if everything's going to go wrong. We know we're good. And now we're, in some cases, even better, certainly on the offensive side. You just look at this group and it's just really cool to watch the confidence that a lot of these players are playing with. And I think, you know, PCA's big home run in this series really speaks to that for someone who hasn't even contributed that much offensively this season to have a moment like that. And as you watch a series unfold where you just know everything is going wrong for the Reds, everything's going right for the Cubs, it just looked like they were the better team. And I think we believe they are the better team, and the records certainly reflect that at this point.
That sense of confidence, it exists in the fan base, certainly, where you can look at the roster as someone who's paying for tickets and say, these are good players, we're a good team, this is something that I can care about and invest in emotionally. But that dynamic is also very important inside the room, where you know that when you come to work every day, you got a really strong chance to win the baseball game. And that's something that PCA said, I think, in his post-game interview on the field with Taylor McGregor. He was like, coming to work right now is awesome. Like, showing up to the field every day rules. And that type of atmosphere during a very long regular season is important. It makes it easier to play. I think players play better in a better environment. That's not rocket science. And I think it is a reason, not maybe the biggest reason, these are just good baseball players, but it is a reason that this team has been so good, and why, like, everyone has been good. They have 12 guys with OPS pluses over 100. Okay? Like, that is hard to do. It's the whole team. Every single player with more than 4 plate appearances. Okay? Every single player with more than 4 plate appearances for the 2026 Cubs has an OPS plus over 100. That means they have all, the whole lineup has been an above average hitter, meaning it is a well above average line. It has been really,
yeah.
And we're not just talking about, like, oh, you know, like, Carson Kelly has been better than you think. Like, no, the reserves, Miguel and Maya, Michael Conforto, Matt Shaw, have all been not just helpful, but, like, legitimate contributors to this point in the season.
Was I a year early on Michael
year
Conforto?
Early on your Conforto love. I was going to say, never wrong, just early, baby.
Oh, man. Last year, I was like, wow, I can't believe the Dodgers got Conforto. He's so underrated, and he was obviously a disaster. But in this role, he's certainly showing up. And, you know, We've taken some time already throughout the season to give some individual love to Ian Happ and talk about how fun Moises Ballesteros has been. But now that you've got Bregman and Swanson and Michael Busch all getting their OPS pluses over 100, and then when you combine it with the fact that something we've said the whole time, this defense is elite, that we knew that we were certainly going to be certain of from the beginning of the season. It is a good looking ball club. However, on the mound, it is a very different story. Now, they continue to get enough outs to win. It certainly helps when you're scoring as much as they are, since they rank in the top 5 in basically every offensive category. But the pitching staff took another blow this week with the news that Matt Boyd, the late blooming all-star from last year and one of the nicest human beings on the planet, needs knee surgery after suffering some sort of strange injury away from the field that he just felt while, like, hanging out with his kids. This does not sound
moral
like
the story
a he's
there.
Out for the year situation.
Moral of the story there is, don't hang out with your kids. I think. I don't have
That's
kids. You don't have kids.
Yep.
Very dangerous to play with your kids. Just go play with your colleagues at work. You know?
Last night, I was folding laundry and I, like,
oh,
got
no.
up and I kind of had, like, a weird feeling in my knee, and I, no joke, I thought, like, oh my God, did I just have a Matt Boyd moment? And I don't even have kids to blame it on. This is just me sitting in my room folding laundry. I guess this just happens when you're in your 30s.
Well, so this is the thing. And when we talk about the injuries that players have, they're almost always on the field because their jobs require physical activity. When you're a person in the world that sits at a desk and works a white-collar job, or if you're like us, I would say we work a no-collar job, like, you are still liable to hurt yourself in the course of existing. Even someone like you, Jordan, whose physical activity, not to shame you, like, you're not out there trying to run marathons, you know, you're not skydiving, you're not engaging in risk, and yet even you can hurt yourself. And so for Matt Boyd to go home and to injure his meniscus enough hanging out with the children to go get surgery is, one, an awful bounce and a comical conclusion to this wave of Cubs pitching injuries, and two, a reminder that we are all frail and fragile, and that life is a gift. And three, don't play with your kids.
Yeah, the conclusion, continuation. I mean, hopefully this is the end of this run, because there are many other Cubs pitchers who have been injured playing baseball. That, of course, includes Cade Horton, the big one who, you know, rookie of the year candidate last year, who we know for sure he's out for the year with elbow surgery. Justin Steele has been working his way back from elbow surgery, but it seems like he's had a couple setbacks, so he's not necessarily on the doorstep of returning. Jordan Wicks, another pitcher who's been dealing with elbow trouble for the last few months. And then essentially their whole bullpen, in terms of the guys that they were really counting on, besides Daniel Palencia, who thankfully just got back. But Hunter Harvey's out. Porter Hodge is out. Caleb Fielbar is out. Shelby Miller. Riley Martin, who made his debut this year. Ethan Roberts, another, you know, less experienced guy who'd been in the majors. So they're missing a ton of arms. Porter Hodge, he's a couple years removed from really being a major piece of this team, but he's another one that I'm sure they were hoping to get something out of this year. And so now you're looking at a bullpen with behind, you know, WBC icon Daniel Palencia is not exactly a stable of household names. Phil Maton, Jacob Webb, or Hobie Milner, they've been around for a while and have had succeeded. Trent Thornton, same thing. But Ryan Rolison, a former first-round pick from the Rockies, who's now having the time of his life after being claimed on waivers by the Cubs. Gavin Hallowell, you know, Javier Assad's in there. But I think that what it makes me think of is really looking at what they've been getting from, and we just saw it again this week, Shota Imanaga, man, and trading for Edward Cabrera. I know Taillon and Colin Ray, Ben Brown have not been quite as reliable, but at least they're getting some real contributions on the front end from starters that they really invested in this past offseason. I think that they have to feel really good about.
So two questions as we spin this forward. One is, can this team win the World Series? What is the likelihood of that? And two is, what do they need to add at the deadline in order to heighten those odds? Because at this point, like, I feel pretty good that the Cubs are going to end up in the playoffs. I'm pretty sure they've had the second largest playoff odds increase from opening day to now, behind the Rays, who we'll talk about. And I think that it looks good. Okay, so what do they need? Let's actually start there. What do you think this team needs? Now, the biggest issue with this club, as I look at it, is the pitching. But it's also that on the offensive side, they don't have someone that scares the bejeepers out of you. But they don't really have room to add anyone, and I don't think it would make sense to add an offensive player. Do you agree with that? Like, maybe you pick up a utility guy or, you know, a reserve outfielder, pinch runner type. But I don't think they're going to make any significant additions on the offensive side of the ball. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think Seiya Suzuki is at least approaching what you're describing in terms of a hitter that you are scared of. And I think it still goes back to the first thing we pointed out, which is that if your whole team is above average, you don't have to have the Yordan Alvarez in the middle of the lineup. Their depth right now on offense is as good as you're going to find
you
in terms of 1-9.
To win the World Series.
Okay.
And I will continue to hang my hat on this fact until I am proven wrong. To win the World Series,
you need to have
someone that is a top 15 hitter on the planet. And I do not think the Cubs have a top 15 hitter on the planet.
I think Seiya Suzuki could finish in the top 15 in WRC+. I think that is a thing that can absolutely happen.
Sure.
And I also think that if we're thinking about it from the standpoint of what can they add, where are you going to? You're not going to replace. None of these guys deserve to be replaced. So I think
your point that
you've made over and over, it's an interesting spot to be. So if they're going to add, it's going to have to be on the mound. We're still in the early stages of understanding what teams you could potentially be plucking from, whether that's, you know, a Minnesota or, I mean, I don't know. We don't have that many awful teams yet that we know for sure are going to be sellers. St. Louis is another team that keeps winning. So if you're dreaming of trading for Riley O'Brien, I also would imagine the Cardinals aren't going to be eager to be helping the Cubs win anything anytime soon, whether they're rebuilding or not. So, you know, it's going to be an arm of some type, and it's just going to come down to whether they have the pieces and the willingness to make it happen. Because as I pointed out on Monday, their farm system is not good, but they don't have anyone else, especially on the pitching side. Their top pitching prospect is also injured, Jackson Wiggins. So there's not really help on the way in the minor leagues in the way that they've kind of had in the last couple of years with guys like Cade Horton. So we're going to have to do something, and it's going to be on Jed to be aggressive.
Foster Griffin, Antonio Senzatella. Like, I could see an arm like that. Ooh, is Senzatella. That going to sell tickets?
The Rockies.
Senzatella.
The Rockies bullpen. The Rockies bullpen is, that is the phone call to make. They have, what, six guys that throw 99? I imagine they would be willing to part with at least one of them. And Senzatella is a really good candidate there. Yeah, he's been tremendous since moving to the bullpen.
Is a huge tangent. One of my favorite moments of the MLB season so far was yesterday. Keith Hernandez, Mets broadcaster, learning about Rockies reliever Juan Mejia. So Juan Mejia, who was Dominican team in the WBC, throws like high 90s with visually, aesthetically, one of the nastiest breaking balls in the league, right? And Keith is watching this like, this kid's got a great arm. And then like he'd rip off another slider and be like, wow, get a load of this guy. And then, like, you know, Juan Mejia walks two guys and gets pulled. And Keith's like, well, that's probably why I don't know about it.
Yeah, but the Rockies have several of those, and Mejia might have the highest upside, and he's certainly one of the youngest, that their new front office, we've acknowledged the Rockies are not going to be historically awful, but I still expect them to be sellers at the deadline because they have responsible, smart people running their organization now, and trading relievers is what you do. And so I could certainly see a match there, whether it is a Mejia, whether it is an older guy like Senzatella or a Jaden Hill, you know, with some draft pedigree there. There's some interesting arms there for sure. So it's just going to have to be a reliever. The question is for these teams, and the Cubs are not alone in this, these teams that are super injured, particularly on the mound, can you afford to wait until July to do something like this? Because as cool as it is to see what Ryan Rollison and Gavin Hollowell and some of these guys are managing to get away with right now, and Palencia is awesome, so if he can stay healthy, you at least have that at the back end. I just worry that at some point here, the innings that you're really asking from these caliber of pitchers is going to catch up to them.
Yeah.
But if you're playing at home this well and you're scoring a bunch of runs and your defense is great, you're still going to get away with a lot. So I still think the Cubs are in good shape.
Last thought here. If you are going to win the World Series, and you're the Cubs, you are going to need to get through the Dodgers and or the Braves and or the Phillies if they get their stuff together, right? Matt Olson, Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber, Shohei Ohtani, Freddie Freeman. Okay. All potential Hall of Fame left-handed bats. Hobie Milner is awesome. Is that the guy you want in October going left on left against those guys? That is a question that they need to be asking themselves.
Point.
And it's like,
it's a great point.
If you need a lefty MF-er to get through that gauntlet, and I don't think the Cubs have that guy on the roster right now. Do they have that guy injured right now? Maybe it's Caleb Thielbar, who is pretty good. Just something to keep an eye on as the Cubs move forward, because I do think you have to think about it that way. Right? It's like, okay,
sure.
It's the seventh inning of the NLDS, and here's Matt Olson with two on and two out. Like, you want to be able to give yourself an opportunity to, like, you are going to need to get those outs. That is a fact. The path between where you are now and where you want to be, it's like, think about it like a game of Candyland, right? With the winding road, and it's just like scarier and scarier left-handed hitters. Do you have the horses to get past it?
It is a great point. I'm just now surveying reliever, lefty reliever F4 and seeing if any names jump out at me. But by the way, back to the Rockies, you know, Brennan Bernardino, he's been fantastic for them. I imagine he could be someone on the move. He's got a zero ERA.
Sean Newcomb.
In 15 appearances. Newcomb, Brian King, who from the Astros, who the Cubs drafted, I should point out, and is now on the Astros. But there are some guys, Eric Miller with the Giants. I could see he's got huge stuff. Now, I mean, that's command wise, you're kind of holding on for dear life with Eric Miller. But
yeah.
If you're talking about big time stuff there, there are some candidates out there, but it's a great point. I know we're thinking, well, now we're talking about like eighth inning of the NLCS matchups. This is a long time from now, but it is, I think, a worthy point. And
let's wrap up the conversation with this. While we are, you know, agonizing about the future, Cubs fans should revel in the present. What will happen will happen. What is happening now is magic. It is wonderful. And yes, the big goal is the big goal, but you'd rather have fun in May than not have fun in May. And the experience of being at Wrigley Field right now is worth the price of admission. And that's enough. Full stop. So kudos to the Cubs. Kudos to the Cubs fans. It has been, I feel lucky that I got to see it in person. It has been fun as hell to watch on TV. Boog and Jim DeShays have been locked in on the broadcast call recently. And the camera work of this broadcast, the way that they pan the crowd, the way that they shoot Go Cubs Go is one of the better artistic decisions in baseball broadcasting, where it's like the team, the cameras are on the team the whole game. The game ends. Now it's about the fans. And I think that that is super
they,
cool.
They go, they like bounce around the crowd and like show different people singing. No, it's it is a great point. So we are enjoying watching the Cubs. For those wondering, they are in Texas this weekend for a little road trip, and then they go to Atlanta next week. So that is a
I believe
juicy
it's a three city road trip. It's a pretty long one. Yeah.
Well, Rangers, well, the third Braves city
is home is White Sox.
It's White Sox. So technically a three city road trip, but they won't be away from their homes for too long. All right, one more team we want to mention before we take a break, and that is the team with the second longest active winning streak, the Tampa Bay Rays, who last night in Boston won the first game of their four-game series. Will we be talking about another mop on Monday if Tampa can take all four at Fenway Park? They got off to a nice start last night with a win, including a just beautiful Junior Caminero home run. I mean, that is just what it looks like. His home runs to dead center field are so special. And at Fenway in particular, I love home runs to center field at Fenway, where it's like, it's not the Green Monster. Yeah. It's not the super deep right field with the short wall and the bullpen or the stupid pesky pole. Dead center where you have the really high wall. They just always look so cool. And Junior Caminero's homer last night was a great example of that. The Tampa Bay Rays are 25-12, which is a half game worse than the New York Yankees and the Atlanta Braves and Chicago Cubs, who have the best record in baseball. Their run differential is only plus 19, but they are finding ways to win baseball games. And with the rest of the American League East, not exactly, let alone the entire American League, but even if you just focus on the American League East, which we thought was just going to be this epic melee that wasn't going to include the Rays necessarily, the Rays are taking advantage and really making stuff happen here. And what's happening here?
Let me spark notes this baseball team for you. They have three good hitters. Now, I'm not saying that everyone else stinks. I'm saying they have three quality above average hitters right now. That is Jonathan Aranda, that is Yandy Diaz, that is Junior Caminero. There's some other interesting things going on with Johnny DeLuca and Chandler Simpson, right? Cedric Mullins has been one of the worst players in the sport. Taylor Walls is swinging a wet noodle up there. For the umpteenth consecutive year, none of their catchers are good. Sure. They have three good hitters. They run the bases well. They're good with runners in scoring position. They're doing all of the things that either classify as a team that knows how to get it done or a lucky team. What are they? We will see. On the mound, though, is where they're buttering their bread. Really historic run prevention performances of late. Nick Martinez is one of the league leaders in ERA. Shane McClanahan has been dynamite over his last handful of starts. Awesome to see him back and going. Drew Rasmussen, one of the more underrated pitchers, starting pitchers in the league. And then their bullpen, remember, which through the first week was off to an all-time horrendous start. And that's why a lot of their full season numbers maybe don't look as good. has been much better recently. And so that's what you end up with. And I struggle with this projecting forward, and here's why. This is what a good Rays team, this is what this Rays team, if they were going to be good, was going to look like, right? This is the best version of this team. And I think they deserve tons of credit for being that. Being like, oh, well, are all the Rays real? Well, the Rays were not going to be real with Taylor Walls. Like, Taylor Walls wasn't going to hit 35 home runs. You know what I mean? Like, this is how it's supposed to work, how it's supposed to go. And for that reason, I'm buying in more than I thought I was going to before I kind of dug into the Rays. Because when they're good, they're pesky. When they're good, they're timely. They're never bashing you over the head with oodles of offense, right? They're more of, they've always kind of been this run prevention unit. Do I think they can give the Yankees a run for their tons of money in the AL East? I hope so. It'd be entertaining. I think the Rays are the funniest foil for Yankeedom when they're good.
Always.
Because Yankees fans, like, the Yankees fans, in my opinion, over the last 10 years, are always the most scared of the Rays. Because they can handle all of the incoming attacks, whether that is on field or culturally, from the other fan bases and teams. But for whatever reason, the Rays are like this disorienting fog that they don't always know how to handle. And so I do hope that the Rays are good so that we can get some fun Yankees-Rays stuff.
Yeah, all I'll say is, you know, the Rays were here in Cleveland a couple weeks ago, and I don't know how else to say it other than they are very confident. That is a team that truly does believe, and they've won, I guess, 9 of 10 since then. They had come in after sweeping Minnesota. They don't sweep Cleveland, but they look pretty good that week and sweep the Giants, sweep the Blue Jays. Now they win this first against Boston. They've yet to lose a division game. They've already swept the Yankees this season. So do I think they're going to keep up with the Yankees? No, but with the rest of the American League playing as terribly as they are, like, sure, why can't the Rays be one of the best teams there? Why can't they be the top wildcard team? I don't want to put that past them. I think what the biggest question with them is always, and just back to how we finished our Cubs conversation, you know, we don't have to go too long on this. They are a difficult team to interpret from when it comes to the trade deadline, no matter what. They are always going in a lot of different directions, and I am curious if, for whatever reason, this is more of a natural, let's just be buyers and go try and win something, because, surprise, surprise, the Rays have some damn good prospects. So if they want to part with those guys and actually try and go get some good major leaguers, they probably can do that, but that would also be very uncharacteristic. And for the most part, the times that they have done that, it has not gone well. You know, he traded Joe Ryan for Nelson Cruz. That was one of the worst moves we've seen in the last 10 years, and I'm sure they regret that. But it would also be cool to see the Rays say, screw it. Let's go try and win a World Series. Like, we have a good team, and we believe in ourselves. We have star power like Junior Caminero. We have some impact pitching. So, I don't know, man. This team is very interesting. Hey, give me a reason to get to the Trop. Let's do it.
Oh, two left. I got two left. Haven't been to the Trop. Haven't been to Minnesota. Get me there. Hopefully that's the ALCS. Last point, in the middle of a very interesting stretch here, they just had three at home against Toronto, four in Boston, three in Toronto, three against the Marlins at home, three against the Orioles, three against the Yankees, three more against the Orioles. So that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of their next 7 series are AL East in this stretch. So when that dust settles, I think we'll have a good idea where the Rays stand. If they're still in the mix at the top after this run, I'm in. Let's take a break.
Yep.
When we get back, we will talk about those Yankees and a very tall, very interesting player. And here, I'll do it. Is this the next Aaron Judge? And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's fly around the league. We had a scary moment yesterday in the Yankees game with Jason Dominguez recently called up, getting hurt, crashing into a wall, making a nice play in the outfield. Went into concussion protocol. Seems like he was cleared on that front, but does need to go on the IL with like a shoulder thing, I believe. That is a bummer. What is not a bummer is who will be coming up in his place. Friends of the podcast, gather round and welcome Spencer Jones to the major leagues. Spencer Jones is one of the most interesting characters in the minor leagues, and now he will be one of the most interesting characters in the major leagues. The things to know, the headline about Spencer Jones: he is the baseball player physically that looks the most like Aaron Judge, except he's left-handed. Top of the scale juice, like raw power, as big as it gets. More strikeouts than, you know, Jordan and I in our local men's league. George Schusterman. We love Spencer Jones as the person. We have interviewed him multiple times. He is a delight. He is an interesting and smart individual. Where are you at right now with Spencer Jones? One of the more volatile, polarizing prospects in the minors. Do you think he's going to get real run in the big leagues to play regularly enough to figure this out? Why are the Yankees doing this? And should people be locked into Spencer Jones moving forward?
I am going to defer a couple of those last few questions to you in terms of where he fits, where the at-bats are going to come. So while I give the Spencer Jones background, you can kind of work on an answer for that one. This would be one of the most interesting call-ups in baseball if he wasn't also a 6'7" outfielder for the New York Yankees. But because he is a 6'7" outfielder for the Yankees, it is all the more fascinating. The road that Spencer Jones has taken to this major league debut this weekend, potentially against Jacob Mizorowski, which is just hilarious for someone who's going
ends.
To try and
makes contact. Someone, it's like Spencer Jones making contact with a Mizorowski fastball is how we all die. Like the core of the earth explodes.
That is. Funny enough, the positive interpretation of that, but taking the guy with the number one, like largest strikeout concerns in the minor leagues among top prospects and be like, hey, can you go hit the guy with the highest strikeout rate? Can you go do that? So we'll see if he gets a start against Mizorowski or I guess Kyle Harrison. Not that that's any better of a matchup. Maybe Logan Henderson on Sunday will be a little bit more of a easing him in. But Spencer Jones, who was there, the Yankees' first round pick in 2022 out of Vanderbilt. In some ways, it has always been this way because he's always been huge and has always hit the ball very far. But the profile has kind of changed here and there over the years. This was a premier two-way player in high school in Southern California. He was drafted by the Angels out of high school, big left-handed pitcher. But he had Tommy John either right before he got to college at Vanderbilt or right after, comes back and is a hitter only, doesn't even really play that much his first 2 years. And then as a junior, he is terrific. And he's striking out a bunch, but he's hitting a bunch of home runs. And he goes in the first round. I think what makes Spencer Jones different than some of the other players with huge swing and miss concerns, but also huge power like Murakami and Bryce Eldridge, who we haven't mentioned recently, who just came back up with the Giants, is that Spencer Jones plays a pretty good center field. So that is a part of the profile that is very interesting and also will maybe influence where he could potentially fit in from a playing time standpoint. This is not a DH only. But his swing and miss concerns are not just that he is swinging and missing in the zone, which he is doing more than really anybody. He's also chasing a lot outside of the zone, which makes him even more susceptible to just get to pitchers know how to get him out. That's been happening at AAA. And yet, because he has this ridiculous left-handed juice, he has done a ton of damage in AAA since he got called up to that level towards the end of last year. He has, 30 home runs in 100 AAA games, which is not a small thing. And he is still drawing a good amount of walks, but it's just so risky. And when I know we've said the same things about Murakami and he's having the success, But there's just parts of his, especially with the way that his swing works, which is also the interesting thing about Spencer Jones. And, yeah, and what has about changed about him, his stance right now is very strange and not what it always was. This is not what it looked like when he was at Vanderbilt. I know he's kind of moved in this direction, and it is one of those things where batting stances are sometimes overrated, because if you pause what it looks like as they are about to actually fire the swing, it usually doesn't look that weird. But when you see Spencer Jones in the box when he's on your television, you're going to be like, what is he doing? He looks so funky. So that's another part of the way kind of he's kind of changed over the years.
It's like a squattier left-handed Judge with the initial setup, maybe a little bit more open on the front side, but he doesn't go right into his load from there. Then he employs this like Otani, Bryce Harper-esque thing where he points his front foot, like the heel of his front foot, up towards the pitcher and like twists it around. It is a weird look. It's working enough for him now. This is never going to be Luis Arraez. Actually, let me say it that way. This is the opposite of Luis Arraez. That's how I will describe Spencer Jones. It's actually that simple. Big boy, hits ball far, swings hard. He's going to hit a home run in the major leagues that is going to make our eyes pop out of our heads. I'm very excited for him. I hope he can stick. I have concerns about how much playing time he's going to get because he's a lefty. Trent Grisham, their starting center fielder, lefty. Cody Bellinger in left, lefty. Aaron Judge in right is a righty, but that guy probably has to play every day. And so it's like, he's going to get DH at bats against right-handed pitching, but by DHing him, you're kind of taking away this valuable thing that he does, which is play a good center field. Does Grisham get DH at bats? Does he get time in center? Grisham's defense is kind of backing up a little bit. But that's not the type of, like, I can see Trent Grisham being a little bit peeved by bringing the rookie up and playing him in center. Like, there are things here to handle. Spencer Jones has never really fit with the Yankees roster, and that is why he has not been up. In a multitude of other organizations, Spencer Jones would have been a big leaguer last year, if not even the year before.
Yeah.
But the Yankees, the reason they have not traded Spencer Jones, the reason they have not traded Spencer Jones is because there is a gap. Let me back up. The reason they have not traded Spencer Jones is because they don't want to get burned. Because there is a 5% chance that Spencer Jones judges it. And it just clicks for him one day, and he is one of the best hitters on the planet. There is a chance that Spencer Jones becomes an all-star capable of hitting 50 home runs. That is not going to happen.
Okay.
It is on the board. Okay?
This is my problem with the Judge comparisons, is that there are so many things in between being a bust and being Aaron Judge that are way more likely that Spencer Jones becomes. So agree, it's higher than a 5% chance that he can become a useful major leaguer. I think it is a 0.0005% chance that he becomes the next Aaron Judge, because Aaron Judge is one of the greatest hitters of all time. So we have to do our best to separate, even though they are both larger than all the other players on the field and hit the ball really far. Let's try and do our best to evaluate Spencer Jones for what he is, for what his flaws have always been, and how can he help this Yankees team finally win a World Series? Because conversation about Anthony Volpe, this is not the most important thing happening with the Yankees, but it is certainly one of the most interesting.
The most interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the ceiling on Spencer Jones is, atmosphere is as high as a ceiling could get, right? And that ceiling, and not wanting to get burned by him finding that ceiling somewhere else, has created this gap for the Yankees in trade talks, where they would trade Spencer Jones for a Rule 6 all-star level player, maybe even an everyday player. But because of the risk associated with Spencer Jones's profile, other teams are not going to give that kind of player up, right? They would give up a Rule 4, maybe not a Rule 6. And so for that reason, the Yankees are like, do we want to trade this guy for a Rule 4? And then like he's like an all-star somewhere else? No, we'll just hold on to him, see if we can do it here. which is in a way done him a bit of a disservice because, he just does not fit with his team. If Spencer Jones is going to be the best version of Spencer Jones, he's probably going to need to be bad at the major league level for a stretch of time, that the Yankees probably cannot afford to let him have. If Spencer Jones, for instance, could just be on the Rockies for a year and a half, I think he would have a higher chance at reaching his potential. Now, granted, the Rockies are worse at major league hitting development, yada, yada, yada. You get my point. The upshot is, this is something to be excited about if you're a baseball fan. I struggle to see how it works given the environment that he's going to be in.
Yeah, I mean, the path to Spencer Jones being on the Yankees in the long term is to show enough in this strange limited role to be considered an option in center field next year when Trent Grisham is probably not on the team. That is how you do it. I think it's also ironic that a lot of these things in terms of the trade value and not wanting to get burned could also be applied in some ways to Volpe, but more so even to Jason Dominguez, who had all this hype coming up, and the Yankees continue to say, we believe in him, we believe in him, we believe in him. He comes with his own problems in terms of a profile, but now he's injured, so he's going to have a role. And then the last thing in terms of just the immediate role in the team, I do kind of wonder if this is also a sign that Giancarlo Stanton is not particularly close to coming back, because that's the name that is still part of this that makes all of this all the more complicated if he is healthy and back playing DH, in which case Spencer Jones is just going to go back to AAA and continue to figure out how to strike out less, and then he'll maybe have that chance next season in the scenario that Trent Grisham is gone. But for now, he'll try to fit in, whatever that looks like, and hopefully he can at least give us one big swing. But to be honest, maybe I'll get burned by this here, I don't think Spencer Jones is really going to be that big of a part of this season unless Giancarlo is definitely out for a long time, which is a very possible, as we know. I'm just not really seeing the path in the same way unless he does become kind of this DH center field type of thing with Grisham. So we will see. Okay, one more bit of news. Is this news? Well, let's talk about it before we get to some of your emails. And that is an update regarding Tarek Skubal, who we, of course, talked about on Wednesday because he had elbow surgery. Uh-oh, elbow surgery for Tarek Skubal. That's not good. As we described earlier this week, this is not season-ending Tommy John reconstructive surgery. That means we are not going to see him pitch again this season. But it was a surgery to remove loose bodies, arthroscopic, that we said, knowing going into Wednesday that he was going to have surgery, this could mean a lot of different things in terms of timeline. However, you did look at the past examples of pitchers who have had this similar surgery and really only found one example, which was Blake Snell a few years back, of someone coming back from this in season in really less than 2 months. Is that a fair assessment of kind of what you found?
Yeah, less than 2 months. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is rare. However, we have this update from John Heyman, who reported earlier this week saying Skubal elbow surgery was a success. He could start working out within days, 2 months, even a conservative estimate, 4 to 6 weeks possible. One relatively small loose body was removed. Okay. This is all that we know as we are recording on Friday morning. This is the only update that we have received about Tarek Skubal's elbow surgery that we are aware that it did happen because the Tigers said he's going to have it on Wednesday. We have not heard from Tarek Skubal directly. We have not heard from the Detroit Tigers directly. And they are very thorough in their medical updates when they tell you they've got a lot of injured guys they'll tell you what's going on. So
yeah,
when we're recording this on Friday morning, we have not heard anything else. This would seem to be an encouraging update. However, I think we have to take it with some grains of salt, as they say.
A container of salt. Now, this is an uncomfortable conversation, but it is one that needs to be had as it pertains to Tarek Skubal. John Heyman over the years has been criticized for his relationship with Scott Boras. I think that some of those criticisms are fair. I think some of those criticisms are within the course of doing business and building relationships with agents. And if you're going to be in the scoop game, that's fine. Everyone's doing many of the things that John is doing. Do you agree with that? However, based upon John almost always getting Boras scoops, based upon earlier this week, John tweeting out, Tarek Skubal is being scratched tonight. Hope and belief is he will be okay, seen as a precautionary move. And then, like, what? An hour later? 30 minutes later? John tweeting, Scoobal will undergo surgery for loose bodies in his elbow. No set timetable. Like, that is... The news disqualified his original reporting. That is a fact. Seen as a precautionary move was incorrect. No matter where John got that information, it was wrong. Okay? And so, as we fast forward back to what we got from John about the surgery, I don't feel comfortable believing it on its face. I don't. And that's a bummer.
Yeah.
I want to. Tarek Skubal elbow surgery was such a success, he could start working out within days. It's like, maybe that is true, but it is telling that we have not heard this from one, the Tigers, two, anybody else, three, MLB trade rumors, which I would say in our industry is like the standard for that as a report, has not done a post on this. Right? As far as I can tell. And I think that is telling. And it bums me out because I don't want to have to talk about like the, you know, journalisticography of this and journalistic ethics and how this works. And like, but as it pertains to this specific thing with Tarek Skubal elbow surgery, I do not feel comfortable believing this on its face. And that is a fact.
Yeah.
And that bums me out.
Well, regardless of that, like, I just don't even, I think we said this to begin with. I don't think anybody, including Tarek Skubal, knows when he's going to be back, including John Heyman, including Scott Boras. So there's reasons that you would want to convey that he's feeling great. I still think about it from the Tigers' perspective. I don't know what benefit the Tigers are going to have by coming out and telling you when they expect Tarek Skubal back. One, because I don't think they will know. And two, because why would you set expectations that this extremely important piece is going to come back sooner than he actually is? So we will get some sort of official update from the Tigers. I do not expect it to be remotely specific. And I think we're just going to have to go from there. Because thankfully, in this case, we do have at least some examples. And so while we have seen in other cases in sports, like Jason Tatum coming back from an Achilles faster than anybody else, sometimes guys come back faster than anybody else. That is a thing that does happen. So maybe Tarek Skubal will be pitching in 4 weeks or 6 weeks. But with the information that we know now in the context around this reporting and the fact that nobody else has given us any sort of official update, unlike some people who saw that and were like, oh my God, thank goodness Tarek Skubal will be back soon and the Tiger season is saved. Mm-hmm. Let's just take a beat and we will see where this goes from here. So I am hopeful that we will see Tarek Skubal pitch again this season, but I'm not exactly, you know, making sure I can make it up to Detroit in a few weeks to be there for a start, you know, before the All-Star break or anything. But we will see how that goes. Okay. Now it is time to do something we have not done in quite some time, and that is a mailbag, folks. You send us some wonderful emails all the time at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. And we wanted to take a little bit of time to acknowledge some of those because we appreciate them. And also, you've been sending some very interesting questions and thoughts and feelings and emotions that we wanted to share. So we'll go through a couple of these pretty quickly before we get to the good, the bad, the ugly later. Where would you like to begin, Jake?
Let us begin, Jordan, with the Astros. Whenever there are good teams, whenever there are bad teams with good players, we get, should the bad team trade the good player discourse? And we got an email that such a discourse should begin with Yordan Alvarez. This is from Owen. Owen says, hot take, the Astros should trade Yordan. The man will get injured, almost certainly. He's an incredibly affordable contract. Every contender can make a place for other than the Dodgers. I would argue the Dodgers would make a place for him in left field. Their core is old and crumbling, and the pitching could be easily cooked for this season. He also has a no-trade clause that kicks in next year. Now is the perfect time to sell high, but they won't, but they should. Jordan Schusterman, what say you?
I'm laughing at the idea of Yordan Alvarez basically being in the Dalton rushing role of only DHing when Otani's pitching. Okay. So here's the deal, folks. Yordan Alvarez, who I believe is has a case to say with a straight face, I'm the best hitter on the planet. He could say that, and I'd be like, I probably not, but maybe. He is under contract for two more seasons after this one at around $27 million, which is, of course, a bargain for a hitter this good. And I've seen some, again, he mentions in the email some reports that he has a no trade clause that is going to kick in soon. I can't verify that anywhere, but if that is true, okay, that's, I guess, important. The bigger question is, are the Astros going to blow this up? I mean, we could talk about Yordan, we could talk about whatever.
And
honestly, you could say that you could have had the same questions about some of the other slow starters who we were not expecting, like the Phillies. If the Phillies kept on losing and losing and losing and losing, what would blowing it up look like for them? I don't think it was going to happen because it's Dave Dombrowski. With the Astros, it's so much harder to say because if they continue to be this bad, I think Dana Brown's getting fired, in which case does that happen before the deadline? Do you have like a national situation where you have an interim running the deadline? Trading Yordan Alvarez would obviously be one of the biggest organizational decisions that they ever make, and they've made some big ones over the years. And I don't know if Dana Brown is going to have license to do that, and I don't know if whoever's going to be maybe in charge after him in the interim is going to be doing that. So no matter how bad they are, I just don't think that he's,
Jim Crane is at the wheel. It is his team. Yeah. He's not the GM. Might as well be.
Yeah,
I would find it incredibly difficult to believe that he is going to trade Yordan Alvarez because Jim Crane believes that this team can compete within the window that Yordan Alvarez is on the team. That is 26, 27, and 28.
Even if that's next year.
And
so
if you think that you want to make the playoffs in that window, you do not trade Yordan Alvarez. You just don't.
Yeah.
That's just not how it works. Yeah. However, I think it is a reasonable decision. If you're looking at this from like a ruthless standpoint, I think the Astros should trade Yordan Alvarez. But I also think the Astros should let their general manager run the team. I also think the Astros should not have traded for Carlos Correa last summer. There are a lot of things I think about the Astros. There are a lot of things I think that they're doing wrong. And my opinions don't matter because I'm not running the Astros, right? And so it's like, a good email. This is just not a question that is like in my brain realm because it's just feels so impossible given the characters that are in and not in control right now in Houston.
So many things are wrong with this team and this organization. Some of it their fault, some of it is brutal injury luck. The window is Yordan on the team, and then Jeremy Pena's last year before free agency is next year. So I could see them, if their playoff odds are 2% come deadline, Christian Walker gone, Paredes gone, you know, some of these pitchers are gone. That's fine. But Yordan and Pena, that's just not happening. So all right, let's go to some emails about food, or do you want to keep it on some Pobos?
Let's stay on the Pobo train. This is an email from Jack. Jack, the email header is "Fire Mike Elias immediately." Jake and Jordan, how you doing? The email subject line is meant to be clickbait. Sorry, but I hope it works. It did work. I'm an O's fan, and I've taken a curiosity to how fan sentiment is developing over the season. The season has not gotten off to a great start. Sentiment is split between blaming injuries and poor performance. It's probably both. I'm also aware that some of the loudest online voices are on the margins of extreme views, which is true of all media, not just sports. That is true. However, these voices tend to be elevated and seen as the standard accepted views. Sentiment then forms around said views. Are we becoming New York fans? Maybe. These voices look for someone to blame. Sights are set on Mike Elias, the president of baseball operations for the Orioles. Criticism ranges from he's doing the best he can with what he has to he needs to lose his job from failure to deliver a single playoff win after a brutal teardown. I have my own views on Elias, but I'm much more interested in hearing your opinion on Elias and specifically what his responsibility is for the current state of this team in the context of his tenure, even more so if the season trends further downwards. Thanks for baseball barbecasting 3 times a week, boys. Jack. You go first, Jordan, and then I'll talk about the team I once loved.
Yeah, I think that for me, I look at the situation and I look at how long he's been there and I look at the ownership turnover and I look at the expectations, the money that now has been spent. He mentions the line and they're always doing with what he can. Yeah, they don't have a $300 million payroll. They also don't have a $90 million payroll. They have spent real money. certainly more recently, you know, with the ownership change. And so that's a line I hear a lot about the Mariners front office, because ironically, like the Mariners and Orioles, especially the last few years, their payroll has been around almost identical. And so you hear the same refrain. It's like, well, John Stanton, I mean, he's not letting these guys actually spend real money. And in some respects, that's true. And in some respects, it's not. And so I still think these teams in the middle, I think for their front offices, you can judge them, especially ones that have been there for that long. That applies to Seattle. And that definitely applies to Baltimore now, as Mike Elias has multiple years removed from being in rebuild mode and being in draft asset, you know, let's draft and draft and draft and draft and draft and, you know, collect all these guys and develop all these hitters and whatever. So it's go time. You should be better than this by now. Last year was certainly disappointing, and you could blame the injuries. You could blame the injuries again. There are some things that are really good about this team that you can credit Mike Elias for. But at this point, as I said, when you consider how long he's been there, how long he's in theory been in contention mode, and what they have accomplished, if you compare him to other front offices around the league, I think he absolutely deserves to be criticized and scrutinized at this stage.
He has agency over the situation, despite the injuries, in a way that not every GM has, because of, one, the money he's been able to spend over the last couple of years, and two, how long he's been there. And so when you're talking about, like, oh, this isn't this guy's team, or, oh, they're hamstrung by the amount of money they could spend, those do not apply in this instance to Mike Elias. The injuries do, but those other large components do not. And when you look at the way that he has spent the money, it's not great. There are some misses. Now, Pete, I'm not, like, worried about Pete. Like, I think he has been a positive force in the Orioles. Like, that is not...
Pete's not my concern.
I'm talking about $18.5 million for Chris Bassett. I'm talking about the three-year, $35 million dollar deal, or whatever it was, $45 million deal for Tyler O'Neill. I'm talking about bringing Andrew Kittredge back on a $9 million deal. I'm talking about the decision to not non-tender Ryan Mountcastle for $7 million, right? All of these things added up are not great roster building decisions. And I think that Mike Elias is good and has shown to be good at draft and development. He has done a good job of that. That is half of winning. That is not the whole thing. And he has not proven himself skilled to this point based upon the outcomes at the other half of this job. Because in this job, you are judged by the results. And his results, zero playoff wins. Again, zero playoff wins. That is pretty damning. And I think that you can blame Elias just as much for his passiveness in 23 and 24 when they were in the playoffs for not capitalizing on what were legitimately good to great teams, as much as you can blame him for the last 2 years of inefficient roster building, where the opportunity was in front of them and they did not necessarily take full advantage and said, you know, the SpongeBob meme, future, future, future. Well, the future does not always work out the way you want it to. And this has very much been the case. Injuries come up, underperformance comes up, prospects are not dependable all the time. And so I do think that if the Orioles miss the playoffs this year, there's a legitimate reason for David Rubenstein to take a hard look at Mike Elias as the person running this team. I think that's a fact.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's just where we can leave it, because sometimes when new owners come in, they just decide right away, I need to get my people. But because of the timing of when Rubenstein came in, it would have felt kind of absurd to cast Elias aside at that point. However,
also,
now he has had multiple opportunities.
Also. Yeah. I'm going to just cut you off here. David Rubenstein, who I think might be a good owner, doesn't know anything about baseball, like, at all. And he has said this many times. Like, he is willing to admit, I don't know about baseball. Mike knows about baseball. Right. I'm letting Mike take it. And I think that is both a good strategy and concerning to a point if Mike Elias is not the right person. Now, again, Mike Elias has done a lot of very good things for the Baltimore Orioles. That is not what I'm saying. But at the end of the day, you are judged on your results. And the results have not been good enough. That is,
and that's the thing. That's why it doesn't matter if David Rubenstein knows baseball or not. He's now watched him do the job enough, and he knows that they have not won as much as he probably would have wanted by this point. So you could apply that to some other places around the league, which are also interesting. But in the Orioles case, I think that that is a good
summation. Let's compare it to the Mets really quickly. Compare it to the Mets really quickly, which is what you just said. The difference between David Stearns and Mike Elias is that David Stearns was an executive in a different city and won. Right?
He won. He did win baseball games.
They were a game away from the World Series in 2018.
They were. That's true.
They were a game away from the World Series in 2018.
He was like, he had accomplished a lot in charge. Yes. Correct.
I would also say that the mythos, the mystique of David Stearns has probably outgrown what his actual skills and results have been. I'm willing to admit that, as good as I think David Stearns' process is. Mm-hmm. But David Stearns, in my opinion, is on a different level of accomplishment than Mike Elias.
I agree.
And I think that's...
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay.
All right. Couple more before we take a break. This is a little
These are just good stories.
Which ones do you want to acknowledge? Yeah, go ahead.
We had a long conversation recently about the folks that brought spaghetti into the ball yard.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Up in Milwaukee. So we got a lot of emails about other people bringing food in. We got one from Joe, who brought in Cincinnati chili to Nats Park in 2023. I don't think anyone noticed outside of our Cincinnati chili group chat. Incredible. But I prepped bags for a four-way. Spaghetti, chili, shredded mild cheddar, onions. With a friend of mine in 2023 to see the Reds when they were in town against the Nets. Beans in a bag to make it a five-way proved to be too much for even culinary degenerates such as ourselves. We had the Skyline hot sauce and oyster crackers to make it a truly authentic experience. We were rewarded for our grotesque but enjoyable efforts with an Ellie De La Cruz missile that wasn't high enough to go out of the stadium, but looked like it might have been hit hard enough to go through the stadium. And there are just some incredible pictures here that we were sent with labeled Ziploc bags. Jordan, what has your Cincinnati chili experience been like as an Ohioan? Have you partaked?
I've
never partaked.
I have twice, I think, I went to Skyline when I was living down near there. I think I'm just a touch below. I don't have a strong opinion about Skyline chili. It is not something I enjoyed. I did not view it as like, wow, this is so great, you have to try it. But I am not like, this is an abomination. I'm like, okay, yep, this is kind of chili, sure.
So chili at the game, pretty good. Not as good as cake at the game. This is an email from Brian. Dear Jake and Jordan, when I cannot speak to the stadium spaghetti policy, I do have a good food story about Camden Yards. I'm a Sox fan, Red, who grew up on the wrong side of Connecticut. When I lived in Taunton, Baltimore in the early 20-teens, my girlfriend and I used to stop at the cheap chain sandwich shop around the corner, bringing our dinner into O's games. Depending on how you see it, those were the golden years before the O's were good again. If you knew where to go, the ushers did not enforce seating assignments. 2013, I made a day of it and went to a game on my birthday, inviting my friends across the DMV. What made the evening so incredible was not the seats, but the fact that we knew the food rules. So my girlfriend baked, frosted, and brought an entire full-sized chocolate cake into Oriole Park. Plus the requisite paper plates and plastic cutlery. You should have heard the comments when we went through security. How about I get a slice of that, hon? We sat and celebrated indefinitely, not our seats. We're in the middle innings. She cut and served slices of the most delicious cake I've ever had, featuring a hidden peanut butter inner frosting and topped with mini Oreos. We had a friend who was a lower bowl vendor. We may have traded a slice for a beer or two. I obviously married her the next spring. Love this.
That's love
cake
right there.
Cake at the game. Cake at the game.
That's awesome. Trading cake for beer that's just efficient considering, you know, prices nowadays.
I'm thinking about doing soup.
That would sound like in a thermos, like warm.
I guess it would be bad in the bag.
I'm just saying I kind of love that idea in when it's 35 degrees in Cleveland, you know, some warm soup to kind of keep you toasty when it's like frigid Midwest April baseball. I do like that idea, but in the summer, that sounds like the worst thing in the world. What are we talking about? Any Alrighty. Others, or should we take a break?
I think it's time to go. Let's take a break. When we get back, we'll unleash the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It's Friday, which means it's time for the good, the bad, the ugly.
One thing good, one thing bad, one thing ugly from the week that was. Jordan, start us off.
Kazuma Okamoto, the Toronto Blue Jays' newest slugger, got off to a sluggish start to his Blue Jays tenure.
Nice.
However, over his last 18 games, this dude is absolutely raking, and I wanted to give some love to our old pal Mike Petriello at MLB.com, who wrote about the fact that Kazuma Okamoto made a very simple adjustment. He just moved back in the batter's box. This is a very basic thing in baseball that is kind of always amazing to me that it's not standard. You can stand wherever you want in the batter's box. However, 98% of hitters will understandably stand as far back towards the catcher as you can so that you have more time to react, more time to see the pitch, more time, et cetera, et cetera, when you don't have a lot of time when you're facing the best pitcher in the world. Kazuma Okamoto, at the start of the season, was not all the way at the back of the batter's box, and he was struggling. But since he made that adjustment, he's hitting 308, 400, 708. With a bunch of homers and looks like the hitter that they paid to come in and kind of rejuvenate this offense that doesn't have Bobichet anymore and is dealing with a bunch of injuries. So I am glad that Okamoto is now hitting his way back into relevance. Murakami, of course, getting plenty of love as well, but Okamoto is the one we felt really good about. And it's really cool to see him just make a tangible adjustment that is simple and has worked this quickly, and I just think speaks to his skill level. And he also, both him and Murakami, from it's sad because what's going on with Imai in Houston is the exact opposite, but from a culture and chemistry and clubhouse vibe standpoint and fitting in with his new teammates, both Okamoto and Murakami seem to be just crushing it. And of course, it helps that they are also succeeding on the field, but they seem to be really, really just great fits in those clubhouses as well. So yeah, shouts out to Okamoto. He's been a lot of fun to watch lately.
So we just talked about how things are going really poorly in Baltimore. Jim Palmer, franchise icon, is not staying silent. Palmer, who is a frequent broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles, does a lot of the play-by-play, is, I believe, the only Hall of Famer that travels and does broadcast still. Barry Larkin does home games for the Reds, I believe, often. But like Jim will go on the road. Like, Jim is in the Hall of Fame. He is one of the most iconic players in the history of the franchise.
Jim is 80 years old.
Jim is 80.
Yes.
And Jim is tweeting. And it's definitely
Hell
Jim.
Yeah.
Jim Palmer, responding to a tweet that said, I don't want to be overdramatic, but the Orioles have ruined my life. Jim Palmer said, I share your pain. I'm on life support, but holding out for a miracle a la 1974 when we won 26 of the last 31. Jim Palmer also tweeted, someone asked, is this a good baseball team? He said, only if you read the newspapers and positive comments from the Oriole players about clubhouse chemistry. Love the belief that they're a good team. But reality is what your record is. New players, new managers, coaches, lots of injuries, but let's bottom line it. They need to be more consistent in all facets of the game. Hope it happens soon. Last one from Jim Palmer here. This is a tweet from someone just directed at David Rubenstein about how bad the team has been. And Jim Palmer just responds to that, woeful baseball. Now, here's what I love about this. Here's why this is good. The Orioles are not good. Jim Palmer is rare for many reasons. Most broadcasters that work for the team would not be this openly critical of the team on Twitter, let alone one that is 80. But because Jim Palmer is in the Hall of Fame, because Jim Palmer is bigger to this organization than Mike Elias, the Pobo, or David Rubenstein, the owner, Jim Palmer could say whatever the hell Jim Palmer wants. And I think that he is tweeting in a way that is both like helpfully critical and respectful and reasonable. So good on Jim Palmer for speaking his truth at the age of 80 years old.
This is beautiful stuff. That first tweet where he says, oh, well, hopefully it's just going to be like 1974, is so funny because he has we, right? We 126 the last 31. Sorry, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, maybe this is not the case. Who else online engaging in a discourse right now was around in 1974 to like reference that as
so
if
good.
That's something that they experienced? Not, right. not, I'm not even talking about someone that was on the team. Even a fan from 1974, I guess David Rubenstein is one of those people that could do that. But otherwise, there's not that many people that could be like, man, phew, 1974, hopefully it's like that. So this
hopefully
is incredible.
It's just like that.
Great stuff.
Like, Jason Stark wrote an article recently about the Phillies and is like, is this going to be like 2012 or 2013 when the last dynasty fell apart? Or is it going to be like 2022 when they fired Girardi and everything was good? And it's like, if you're a fan, you're like, I remember when those things happened. Whereas for this, it's like, oh yeah, just like the 1974.
It's like, part. Yeah, I remember tweeting about 2022 and it's like 1974 is a long time ago. All right, let's go to bad. My bad is the San Francisco Giants offense, which is so bad, they are last in essentially every category, including stolen bases, not batting average. They're getting some hits. They are so bad at everything else, including home runs. But the thing that I really want to harp on here in just very simple terms is that they are not walking. Jake Mintz, it is easier to walk than it has been in decades. This, with ABS and with how the zone has changed, teams are walking like crazy. It is, if you just stand there, there's a good chance you're going to be getting first base. And however, the Giants are not only just not walking, not only do they rank last in this era, they have one of the lowest walk rates in the last 100 years in a year that it is easier to walk than almost any other season in the last few decades. Wow. They are such a mess right now, and I don't know how they get out of this. Shut out for the seventh time this season already. And this is terrible. This is terrible offense. They have some good hitters in theory, but whatever they are doing right now collectively is not working. I am in shock at how bad this has gotten.
Thing I would like to note about Tony Vitello and the San Francisco Giants. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At some point in June, there will be college baseball head coach openings. Okay? Big
mm-hmm.
ones.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, Tony Vitello's name will get thrown around. Because remember, if Tony Vitello wants to return to college baseball, he will have to jump ship at a weird time. Right? And I don't think it will happen this year.
Well,
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah. He could presumably get fired in the middle of the season and then just go pick up a job. Yes.
No. I'm just saying he jumped ship from college baseball at a weird time this time. So, I mean, if he wants to show up in the middle of fall ball somewhere else, then maybe. But yeah.
With the Giants playing this poorly, just keep an eye on that. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. The one thing I'll say about Tony, it bums me out that this roster is such a mess that I don't even think we are getting any sort of, that this is Tony Vitello's foray into this is just kind of sucks. This is not me defending him
fault.
Or that he
this
is a solution, but it's just like, I wish that this experiment would happen with a team that would at least give him a chance to be good. And maybe it is all his
Absolutely.
Fault and that's why they're not walking. But I just, that part kind of is starting to really bum me out whether he's a big part of the problem or not. So anyway, what's bad for you?
Hawaiian Bros.
The buns? Talk about the buns?
No, the chain. The chain. Oh. Hawaiian Bros. For those of you unfamiliar with Hawaiian Bros, Hawaiian buns, Hawaiian bread.
Oh, I'm thinking of King. I'm thinking of King's Hawaiian, like King's Hawaiian, like the sweet rolls. Oh man, those are so good. Okay, sorry, I assumed that that was the company we're talking about. Tell me about Hawaiian Bros.
I'm talking about Hawaiian Bros Island Grill, a fast casual chain for whom, quote, aloha spirit is our secret sauce. And Hawaiian Bros were inspired every day to spread the aloha spirit. They sell chicken and pork. It's probably actually pretty good. Like Hawaiian food bangs, dude. And there are a number of Hawaiian Bros outposts, it seems, in the Kansas City area. And so for this season, Hawaiian Bros and the Kansas City Royals did a promotion called Plates for Plates, where if the Royals scored six or more runs at a home game, Hawaiian Bros loyalty members got a free lunch plate. And for the start of the season, it was not a problem because the Royals weren't scoring any runs. But then the Royals got hot and scored six runs or more for five straight home games. Okay, this is not in a win. The Royals can lose 7-6 and you still get your lunch. So anyway, the Royals for five straight games score six runs and Hawaiian Bros is getting bombarded. Like, they are losing money. This is from Eric Graves. Hawaiian Bros says they've already given out 41,000 free meals. That's part of the Plates for Plates promotion. Project is blown up after the Royals scored six plus runs, five straight home games. And there's a picture, you know, of the cars backed up. It's great. This is so good. What happened, Jordan? Hawaiian Bros changed course. They were losing so much money that they changed the promotion. And it is now a BOGO. They have changed the free plate to a BOGO. This is a statement from Hawaiian Bros. An open letter to our guests, rewards members, and Royals fans. Well, this got a little out of hand. Laugh emoji. When we launched Plates for Plates with the Kansas City Royals, we hoped for some fun, a little buzz, and a few free plates along the way. Safe to say, you guys took it from there. You packed our restaurants, lit up social media, and turned this into something way bigger than a promotion. And honestly, we've loved every second of it. But man, it's been wild, all caps. Our restaurant teams have been absolutely crushed in the best way possible. Working around the clock to keep up with the response, the lines, and the wave after wave of Royals fans showing up hungry. So to keep Plates for Plates sustainable, exciting, and alive for the long haul, we're making an adjustment. Beginning immediately. Don't put it in the newspaper that we were losing money. When the Royals plate, wink, six or more runs at home, Hawaiian Bros rewards members will unlock a free classic plate lunch with the purchase of a plate lunch the next day. The celebration continues, the tradition continues, and the spirit of Plates for Plates absolutely continues.
Wow, I have so many thoughts.
First of all, AI, right?
I guess so here's the thing. I am just wondering, is there someone that works at Hawaiian Bros when they were coming up with this that was like, guys, can we make it like
seven runs, maybe ten?
And they're like, nah, the Royals don't score. That's what's the big deal?
The Hawaiian Bros CEO looking at Pakoda.
I guess it's a good sign that clearly people like Hawaiian Bros. You know, I don't think people. Like, it tells me that this is a good product, I think. But
sure.
Just terrible execution and disappointing change of course. But also for the sake of their employees, I guess this is probably for the best.
The absolute worst part of this is that 4 days ago, the CEO of Hawaiian Bros doubled down. Scott Ford, CEO of Hawaiian Bros, responding to a tweet that said, the Hawaiian Bros CEO seeing the Royals have another six-run game at home. It's a gif of Matthew McConaughey and Interstellar banging on the wall in despair. And Scott Ford responded, "Nah, I'm loving it. Go Royals." Shaka emoji, pineapple emoji. Update. Well, apparently not.
Update. Update. Not loving it. Not loving it. Speaking of loving it. Do you want to do your ugly now?
Yeah, I'll stay on the.
You like that transition?
I'll stay on fast.
Like
food.
That transition?
So good, Jordan. Bada.
He's loving
ba,
it.
Ba, ba.
Go ahead.
I'm loving it. Here's another song Ronald McDonald sang this week. The national anthem. This happened last week at a minor league game. Charlotte Knights hosting the Gwinnett Stripers. And it's Ronald McDonald singing the national anthem. Just full Ronald McDonald with pretty solid pipes, letting it eat. Full clown outfit. The players can't help but laugh, obviously. This was just part of like a charity thing. The most ugly. Ronald McDonald singing the national anthem. It's just that is as ugly as it gets. This sent me down a Ronald McDonald rabbit hole. There's some really strong Ronald McDonald baseball ads from back in the day. If people want to find those, just Google Ronald McDonald baseball minus anthem. So you can get all the anthem results out of there. They'll find some really good stuff. And I should mention that Ronald McDonald, this is not Ronald's first baseball foray this year. As Ronald McDonald threw out the first pitch at Citizens Bank Park earlier this year, alongside Ambassador Satoshi Katihara, the Consulate General of Japan in New York. Those were the two ceremonial first pitches at the Phillies game on like March 29th. So, Ronald McDonald.
Wow. Ron. Did we call him Ron? Probably not.
Ron McDonald.
All right. Ron McDonald. My ugla is Gavin Sheets, a former Charlotte Knight. Who's to say, I wonder if he ever got to experience Ronald McDonald singing the national anthem at the Charlotte
Probably
Knights
not.
Game. Gavin Sheets of the San Diego Padres hit the first splash hit of the year.
Wow.
Splash hit, of course, a home run hit directly into McCovey Cove. It cannot bounce. And that is very important because there have been ones that bounce, including Jung-Hoo Lee earlier this season, who thought he had the first splash hit of the year. But if it bounces on that sidewalk before, it does not count as an official splash hit. The point is, I've spent the last few days going just crazy deep on every splash hit that has ever happened. Thankfully, the San Francisco Giants keep a good log of this on their website. And Gavin Sheets being the first one to do it this year just gave me reason to go ahead and look at it. What was ugly about his in particular is that the pitch before he hit one into the cove on the bounce that was a foul ball. Strained it out. Adrian Hauser did not make enough of an adjustment. Gavin Sheets did. He hits it into the water, which is great. This was the 175th splash hit all time, the 67th by a visiting player. The Giants have accounted for 108 of these splash hits. There have been only 3 splash hits in the postseason. Can you name them, Jake Mintz?
Barry Bonds, Bryce Harper.
Nice. Nice. Is
I'll
no
go
way.
Brandon Belt?
No. So Brandon Belt does have many of these, but he does not have one in the postseason. The lone other
Bryce
postseason
Harper off
splash
Hunter
hit.
Strickland.
Correct. Bryce Harper for sure. Barry Bonds did it once.
Max Muncy?
Somehow only once, although I guess it... No.
In the DS and...
Rick and Keel in 2010.
Oh, with the Braves.
Wow.
Yes.
With the Braves. So Rick and Keel's got one. Yes. So just a couple other splash hit fun facts before we say goodbye. Brandon Belt is number 2 behind Barry Bonds for most splash hits with 10. You know how many Bonds had?
53.
So ridiculous. Not quite. 35. 35 for Bonds. Then we got Belt at 10, Sandoval 8, Mike Yastrzemski 7, Jock Peterson 6, current Charlotte Knight Lamont Wade Jr. with 6. He's way up there.
Loving it.
Denard Snow had 5. And then the last note I just want to give here, by the way, the guy who's allowed the most splash hits, Tim Lincecum with 5, which is kind of interesting. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention is that there are some teams that have not hit one, but they're all American League teams. There's also one National League team that has not allowed a splash hit, and that is the Pittsburgh Pirates, who this weekend are in San Francisco. So, if I know Paul Skenes isn't pitching, but if one of these Pirates pitchers serves one up, just know that that will be history. But guess what, folks?
Jordan?
The Giants don't hit home runs, so it's probably not going to happen. But when the Pirates don't allow home runs either. So that is something I'll be watching this weekend, in addition to a whole bunch more baseball. We got Braves at Dodgers, Yankees at Brewers, and plenty more else. But we've gone long here on this Friday episode. Do you have one other thing before we say goodbye?
I have a story before we get out of here.
Yep.
Kids, if you're under the age of 10, you're not allowed to listen to this. This is safe for work, but for reasons that will become apparent, you're not allowed to listen to this, okay? Because I don't want to, this is like ruining Santa Claus type stuff, okay? So I'm at the yard yesterday, Nats Park, and I'm wearing this hat, my Sabres hat, go Sabres.
Let's go Sabres.
Yep, wearing my Sabres hat, yep. And I'm talking to our friend, one of the ushers there, Hirsch. Shouts out Hirsch. Mm-hmm. And it's weather day at Nats Park, Screech is out and about. Their mascot dressed up as a weatherman, like in the yellow coat and whatnot. Screech walks over to me and waves and then stops in his tracks. Screech does. And Screech points at my hat, my Sabres hat, points at his heart, thumbs ups me, and I go, "You're a Sabres fan?" Screech goes, nods yes, and then Screech points at my hat, points at himself, and points at the ground. And I'm like, "You're from Buffalo?" And Screech starts nodding like viciously and walks away. And this was one of the funniest interactions I've ever had at a ballpark, right? Because Screech, whoever's in Screech, was willing to maintain
Didn't say a word.
Is it Screech canon that Screech is from Buffalo, maybe? Probably not. But that the person within Screech needed to go Sabres me and did so without speaking. All-time moment for me.
Dude,
yesterday.
Dude, that speaks to what we have learned. Buffalo is different. I mean, these people are just different. And I mean that
points
in the best
the
way
hat.
Possible. Let's go
points
Sabres.
To the heart. Points to the hat. Points to the heart. Points to the ground. "I'm from Buffalo," said the enormous furry bird.
Well, I am so glad that the Washington Nationals are on the road so that Screech can sit back tonight and enjoy Tage Thompson and the boys getting after it in game
Screech.
2, coming for the cup. Enjoy, Screech.
Screech. Screech, if you're not pissed for me blowing your spot up, hit me up. If you're the Screech
Let's
person.
Let's hang out. Let's watch the birds.
I live here. You probably live here. Let's watch the Sabres together. So I will report back if I hear from Screech,
oh
the Sabres
God.
Fan, me and Screech watch some hockey together.
Thank you to Carter Singh, Ingrid Rosas, for producing this beast of a Barbacast. Thank you to everyone who emailed us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Enjoy the weekend of baseball, and we will be back on Monday. Thank you, friends. Goodbye.